Hey, Richard, you know, when I was thinking about you always have this incredible sense of optimism. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, I being raised in New Orleans and in the French Quarter, it was such a fascinating place to grow up. And I had very bad asthma as a child, very bad, and I slept under an open umbrella with a vaporizer and a sheet for the first 12 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't a big sleeper. And I couldn't wait to get up in the morning. I couldn't wait to experience life. I couldn't wait to see things that were in my room. I couldn't wait to go in the living room. I couldn't wait to pet the dogs. I couldn't wait to get dressed and go to school. I couldn't wait for the next adventure. You know, I've always been someone that my brother always said, one day I'm not going to die, I'm just going to actually combust. I guess I see all the colors, I just keep rushing to that rainbow.
So to change subjects very quickly, Katrina must have been a very, very sad moment for you.
Well, remember, I have been through many hurricanes in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
One year we were lying on the floor of our house in the French Quarter, and our entire roof came off and moved into the street. And my father's remark was, look how nice the stars look.
Oh, yeah. So that's where you got a sense of optimism. The glass is always half full.
Yeah, very Renaissance eclectic people. They both had been in show business. My mother was a Ziegfeld Follies girl. She danced all around the world. She was a gymnast. She did the fan dance. You know, she did all of this. My father was a singer, dancer on Broadway, and all that stuff. So I was raised with that sort of just look for the sunshine and find your gold mine. You know, that was sort of the big thing. Just enjoy each day.
And what kind of kid were you?
What kind of child was I? I never was a child, I think, because my parents were so much older.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, my father was 50 when I was born. My mother was almost 40. And so I was raised with older parents. And I my father didn't work. He was a stay-at-home mom. And my mother sold lipsticks in a department store. And that upset me at a very early age, because I saw everyone else's father get a briefcase and suit and go to work, but my father stayed home and did the laundry, painted, wallpapered, made curtains, cooked, shopped, he was a Renaissance man.
Right.
But it upset me he didn't work. So I started working at the age of 8, selling pralines on the street corners. Pralines are those little sugary candies made with pecans and you know, I'd crumble up these pralines and put them on a silver tray and I'd stand and I would let people taste them. And that's how I got to know a little bit about who I was and what I wanted. And I got to meet all these fascinating people from all over the world who came to New Orleans for that same excitement that I lived with every day.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a Las Vegas of the South in some ways. I mean,
Remember, it's 28 blocks. It's like a little
right. Jewel.
It's like, have you been?
Yeah, sure. Many times.
So it's a little like the Venice, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm.
With those
right. Little
streets and all those fascinating places. But it has this old charm about it that makes people welcome. And also, the people there are quite unusual people. We look at life, I think, a lot differently than most cities look at life.
How so? What's the difference in the outlook of life of New Orleans?
Oh, it's be happy, be merry, fry small oysters. Let's go to the French Market and pick out Creole tomatoes. It's surrounded by a touch of religion, because I was raised extremely Catholic for not being a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus is on fun, having a good time, doing things and seeing things you've never done. And it's just unlike any place I've been. And I went to college in Italy, so, you know, I spent a lot of time in these very unique little vessel cities like New Orleans.
Where did you learn about food, the good side of food and the bad side of food?
I am a compulsive eater. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first words out of my mouth were not mom or dad. It was Renaissance. That's how I was raised. I was raised, here was the restaurants around me where I was raised. Across the street, Arno's. Around the corner, Brennan's.
Right. Galatoire's.
A block away, Galatoire's. Two blocks away, Antoine's. Quarter Two Sisters. So I was raised, as most people are raised, and I read all your questions, and I know you're getting into this. I was raised that food is not just love. It's everything. It's everything. It's every emotion you can put in. It's 3 days of making gumbo, and, you know, on Fridays, we couldn't eat meat back then, and, oh, my, it was just nothing but crawfish and crabs and, you know, fried oysters, raw, you name it. I woke up smelling my father cooking breakfast in the morning. That was my alarm clock.
Mm-hmm.
Sausage, thick bacon, homemade waffles, eggs Benedict. This was my breakfast. There was no cold cereal from Mr. Richard Simmons. I mean, these were omelets and fluffy eggs and, you know, silver dollar pancakes and that's how it was.
Did it continue through lunch? Was that also a big lunch, dinner?
It was our Catholic school. Mm-hmm. And while other people may have been eating, you know,
bologna
and gravy, and we were eating red beans and rice,
uh-huh,
homemade sausage, fresh buttered buns. You know, it was just, the food was sensational there. You know, it could have won an award. And then dinner was a big event. A big event, because my father cooked everything from scratch. So one night it would be all Chinese food. The next night it would be all Italian, veal Milanese and fettuccine Alfredo. And he got cookbooks, and he just, you know, you can't imagine the kind of food I was raised on until all of a sudden you go to the doctors and they use the term obese. And that's when your whole life changes.
When did you first hear the word obese?
When I was 8 years old.
And what? And how was it described to you? Did someone say you're obese?
It was not to me. It was on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
It was on a chart, and I had no idea what it was, and I had to go look it up. I mean, I was 200 pounds in the eighth grade.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was a chef by the time I was eight. I mean, I could make, you know, you name it, I could make it. You want crawfish etouffee? You know, it takes me about 2.5 hours, but I can make it for you.
Were your parents also heavy?
No, my parents were thin. My father was probably weighed 148 to 50 pounds, which I weigh now, and my mother weighed, I'm going to say, 122 pounds.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I had a brother who was extremely thin and was an extreme picky eater. Well, you know, I used to lick the decals off the, I mean, you know, one day there'd be a rose and the next day it wouldn't be there.
Why do you think you were the only person in the family to become obese? Do you think it's DNA? Do you think it's behavior?
I think it's because I ate voluminous amounts of food, number one. And number two, and we'll talk about this later, why this is such an epidemic. I hated the word exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Hated it.
What did exercise mean to you?
Exercise meant to me that I'd have to be in the schoolyard. And I'd have to be in a circle, and then there'd be two people picking people for teams.
Right.
I would never get picked.
Right.
And
so it was drudgery.
It was worse than that. And mm-hmm. then, you know, I had all these medical problems. So all my doctors wrote all these. I never had to take PE, ever. Ever, 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 not one day, not even in high school. Never, 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 never. Bad feet, bad knees, a deformed femur bone, asthma, sinus, you know, all that stuff, all rolled into one. I had a lot of medical problems as a kid.
When did you begin to address your personal problems of obesity? Was it as a child? Was it young?
When I was, you know, the minute I got the news that I was obese,
mm-hmm.
next thing I knew I was, you know, talking to a girl in class and her mother had diet pills and, well, you know what? I began diet pills. at 8.
And that becomes a whole pattern
of... Well, then you go from diet pills, and then, you know, the mother finds out you're stealing them, and then you're punished, so there's no more diet pills. And then you start laxatives. You start anything that you can get your hands on.
And you start this cycle of really...
You go from that cycle, I went to throwing up,
mm-hmm.
Which was you'd eat, and then you'd go right in the bathroom and stick your finger down your throat, and you'd throw up. And you do that 3 to 4 times a day. You do that if you binged in a snack. You know, you go in the kitchen, have a piece of fruit, you know, 4 pieces of fruit later in a candy bar, you're throwing up.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I went to starving, you know. So I went through the whole gamut of eating disorders, going from 268 pounds down to 119 pounds.
And at what time frame was that? What were the ages of, from the, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, from 8 on, and all through high school, this is what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then I went away to school, and that's when I starved and just, you know, lived on water and iceberg lettuce and lost 123 pounds in 2.5 months.
And how did you feel? How did you feel emotionally?
Well, you know, gaining weight is a high, Paul, and you know, most probably you're just a little teeny thing, and you bike, and you have little teeny waist you've had all your life. But you know, when you're trying to lose weight, you get a high too. When you starve, you get a high. When you're taking diet pills, you get a high. And all you keep on thinking about is, I'll lose the weight and everything else in my life, get that crystal carriage and the horses ready, because everything in my life is going to be fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, there's an element missing. One of your first questions here is what motivates people. You know, the really thing that's missing in this whole thing is you're not doing it because you love yourself. You're doing it to please others. You're doing it to compete with others. You know, you're doing this because you think you're going to find someone to love you and a better job. And, you know, all of those things will follow when you lose weight. But if you lose weight and you're motivated the wrong way, you'll either get sick or die, or you'll gain all your weight back.
Has the obsession of food ever... Has food obsession ever really left you?
No. I'm obsessed with it every day. I cook every week. You know, I'm faced with food all the time. I love it to this day. I'm gonna, you know, this is my last year in the 50s. I'll be 59 next month.
I know. I saw that you were going to be soon to be 60.
Yeah.
I can't think of you as a 60-year-old man.
Now, are you in your 30s?
Am I in my 30s? I wish.
Oh.
No, I'm 53.
Are you 53? Because you have a very young voice, too. And you know what? People that do cardio, I just wrote an article about it on my website, and I have a website that I do.
I know. I've seen it. I like it. It's a good site.
And today I wrote a message, and I got over... I don't know how many hundreds of emails from this one message. So, you know, sometimes you get a message and it really hits a chord. I have to watch everything that I eat, Paul. I am a compulsive eater to this day. If there is cookies in the house or a bag of potato chips and it's opened, I'll go down at the bottom. But I don't keep those things in the house anymore because...
How do you keep them out of the house? I mean, how do you really, when you go out shopping or you go out to any store, you're walking...
You know, you can't imagine Richard Simmons going to a supermarket. Okay, here I am down the aisles. Richard, could you read the ingredients? Tell me, what do you think of this sauce? Is this a good sauce? Now, what is the difference between, you know, and so you go through that.
All right.
And then you have to explain every vitamin and every fruit. You know, so I don't really go. And you can't imagine, can you imagine Richard Simmons going down to the cookie aisle?
No.
The potato chip aisle, you know?
The pictures, it would be taken by the tabloids.
But I live, you know, I only go out to dinner once a month. You know, I really work hard that day, so I'm not going to overdo it. My philosophy now is, you know, what motivates me and what should motivate anyone who's trying to lose weight and get in better shape is loving yourself. And I didn't love myself going through all those eating disorders. But now, because of what I've done in my life, my accomplishments, I love me, so I am motivated to take good care of me, because I look at our country and in the shape it's in. And I thought, after being in this industry almost 40 years, that there would be other people that would follow me and do this kind of good. And the only people that have followed me are people that want to get their hands on these people and perform surgery, or sell them something that's going to be quick fix, or, you know, liposuction their fat off. And, you know, that's wrong. That's just simply wrong.
Why is it wrong? Why are these new methods wrong?
Because, you know, I just got off the phone with a lady just now. She's 420 pounds. I knew her when she was 190. But, you know, people, you can give out the greatest information until people are ready. Now she's going to go have this surgery, okay? She shouldn't have this surgery. She's not emotionally ready to have this surgery. She's not doing this because she loves herself.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing it because she thinks it's a quick fix and she'll lose a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to tell you about the botched up letters I have on my desk right now from people who weren't so lucky with these lap band surgeries or the gastric bypass or the 10 other surgeries they've done. They've had complications, had a second and third surgery, had, you know, blood clots and all kind of problems. You know, your body has to be ready for the surgery. And most importantly, Paul, your mind has to be ready for this.
How much do you see depression and other mental health issues tied up with obesity? Do they always go hand in hand?
The majority of people, here's what happens. Some people grow up with a lot of love and self-worth and parents that compliment them. Not every person had that kind of a childhood. Then you have the knocks of life, the ups and downs, relationships don't work, you get fired, you know, just all kind of things that can happen. And what Americans do the most, and I wrote a little book called Walking Among the Ruins. People walk among the ruins of their life. This didn't work out, that didn't work out, look, I should have done this, look, I'm at this age, I should have this much money in the account, my bank account. You go through all this stuff. And when you're walking among the ruins, a lot of people are eating because we believe that eating solves problems. And so as you're walking among the ruins of your life and you're gaining weight, you don't believe in yourself, you don't love yourself, and you totally just exist on this planet. And that's what millions of Americans do today.
Richard, why do you think this is uniquely American? You know,
it's
Europeans
not.
Love food, but why but don't not. We see... I just got back from Europe 2 days ago in Stockholm and in Copenhagen.
Yeah, but look where you went. You went to two very healthy places. Two very healthy places
right.
You visited.
Well, not you know, Copenhagen, people were smoking like fiends, but they were thin.
Yeah, but again, in Europe... Some European countries, because I get all these reports from doctors and medical reports, there's a lot of obesity problems now because of the processed food that we've introduced and because of the Game Boys and TV, the same things that are keeping kids in their house, not moving. It's the same thing over in Europe.
So we're exporting this bad behavior in some respects.
Japan's exporting it. They sent all the Xboxes and all the computer games and everything to all of these countries, and the kids have become very lethargic. And lethargic kids usually belong to lethargic parents. I mean, look at the structure of the workplace and the work job in America today. You don't have just one parent working. You usually have both parents working, you know, to make ends meet. Some of them even have a second job. They're raising kids. They're not being a good example with food. They're bringing in stuff, you know, take out stuff and process food, so the kids are getting a taste of that. They don't see mommy and daddy exercise. You know, then they go to school, and the parents go, well, the school should do that. The school should teach them. As you know, there's hardly no PE in the schools anymore, and I'm working on changing that.
How are you working on changing that? What are you doing?
Well, I went to, you know, I put up a questionnaire, RS Ask America, and I asked America all about PE, how many times a week, what do they do, their eating patterns. And I did the Today Show and David Letterman and everybody and Howard Stern and got over 60,000 questionnaires filled out.
Wow.
From these questionnaires, I found out what the problem is. The problem is, since the No Child Left Behind law, was introduced by President Bush 5 years ago. It really emphasized reading, math, and science.
Right.
And out the window went everything else.
Right.
Including,
and test scores.
Yeah, test scores. Nutrition and PE. Now, because I had such a bad taste of PE, I think that the schools that do have a little PE are running it just like they ran it in New Orleans when I went to school. It's sports, it's picking people, you know, and to me that's very wrong. So I took all this to Washington, and I met with some congressmen. I now have 18 congressmen supporting my bill, which is called H.R. 1224. And it's trying to get PE in the No Child Left Behind Act.
And does it look good?
Well, here's the problem. The National School Board hates the word mandatory, because when the No Child Left Behind law came about, they had a mandatory to teach an hour of this and an hour of science and 2 hours of math and then all of these testing. And, these kids are not, their scores are not good. And, you know, I believe that if we had my ideals of fitness in schools, we would have kids that were healthier, not so depressed, not becoming diabetic too, kids, and that their test scores would go up. Bringing in the same three things that you do. Here's the three things that you do, Paul, to be in shape. You do your cardio, you do your stretching, and you do your strength training. And you do all three if you want to be a healthy person.
Right.
The same goes for the kids. When I go to schools and teach classes, I use their music, and I bring in cardio steps, I bring in strength training with bands and cords and light weights, and I go stretching. Or yoga, Pilates, and the kids love it because they're doing it to their own music. It's non-competitive. The music goes on. The teacher does her thing or his thing, and then they move. So that's what I'm trying to get back into the schools.
One of the things I found interesting and when I was looking at your website and your bio was you said one of the programs that you're involved with is educating parents and children. And the word you used was, I want to reach them before their fitness fate is sealed. When is the fitness fate sealed? Is that different for each individual?
It is. You know, if you read my message today, I talked about what's in your future. And I talked about, will I be going to hospitals in the next 1 or 2 decades? And will you be in the hospital with a stroke and a heart attack? You know, what is your fate if you continue to eat like this and you continue to be inactive? Well, your fate is either heart attack, strokes, other medical problems, or death. And so I'm trying to save them from that. Because if I can start now and help them, kids and everybody, then as they get older, they're not going to have these medical threats that are going to happen to them.
You know, it's easy to blame the victim and to take a look at someone who is overweight and see a lack of discipline. How responsible are people for their own weight problems versus how responsible are we, society, culturally, because of the way in which we emphasize bad food, bad lifestyles?
Well, that was a couple questions. I do believe that it is far worse being overweight today than ever before in the history of the United States. You know, I was born in the 40s, and the whole competitive looking like a model sort of started in the 60s, and it's gotten even worse now because many of our role models are anorexic or borderline anorexic, and we're looking up to people that we really shouldn't look up to, because I don't think you should look up to someone just because they have a good body. I think our problem is that we have become very overworked and a very tired society.
Mm-hmm.
When a man comes home after working 2 jobs, his first thought is not to get on the treadmill, which most probably he's still paying for the next 2 years. He wants to eat and go to bed. So we become very lazy. And, you know, we always talk about the kids in front of the computer. Let's talk about the parents in front of the TV.
Right.
You know, we eat there. Some people eat and sleep and that TV is on a pedestal, and we adore it. We've just become inactive because, you know, if you don't have a lot of money and you have a lot of bills, you have to work hard, and that may take two jobs or three. I mean, I sit here all day, people saying to me, I can't afford to eat healthy. I can't, you know, I can't afford to join a gym. I can't, you know, can't afford to get a second job. You have to do something. But in our society where money's become more important and owning property and driving that car and all of those things become more important, you know, we have to work for it. And when you don't work for it and you feel like a failure, you feel unsuccessful in your life, that's when you get depressed. You were talking about, you know, mental problems. That's when you can fall into many kinds of depression.
How did we come up with this notion that fat people are funny, a barrel of laughs? Is there anything funny about being fat?
Well, remember this. At the beginning of the motion picture world, we didn't know what to do with, you know, everybody wants to see pleasant-looking people. And so, you know, early on in cinematography, overweight people were used as the butt of a joke. You know, you saw a fat man slipping, or you saw a fat lady couldn't do something that a thin lady could do. And so that has always been that. And I have to tell you something, there is some merit to that, because as a child being obese, you know, you had to be witty if you wanted to stay alive, because, you know, you were the butt of all the jokes, and you were told things about yourself so often that you began believing them. So that's how it's always been. Even as we look at a movie like Eddie Murphy's Norbit, where she's playing a morbidly obese woman, and people are just laughing away. You know, you wouldn't laugh if George Clooney did that, or you know, someone else of that look. But it's always been that way, and a lot of people are raised that way. When we watch Laurel and Hardy on television, when we watch, you know, other celebrities that are very overweight that play comedic roles, and we start to believe, well, you know, maybe someone will like me. They'll look beyond my fat, they'll look beyond my girth, and they'll think I'm funny, and they'll accept me. A lot of it has to do, Paul, with acceptance.
Mm-hmm. When Richard, you know, I often hear that when one spouse loses a lot of weight, the marriage is transformed in many times in a negative way, because the other spouse is God's.
Oh, jealousy. But you have to tell you something. If both, let's say you have two people, a husband and wife, that are both overweight, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If one goes on a food and exercise program and the other one don't, she has maybe a 15% chance of success.
A 15%
chance of success.
Right,
and
right.
That's because, are you married?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you marry your eating partner?
Yeah, she's a marathon runner, and, you know, so we're both pretty active, yeah.
Okay, so this is what happens in our society. When you say I do to somebody, you're saying I do, and one of the reasons I do is because, God, do we love to eat out.
Yeah.
We love the same food. We don't like the thin pizza. We like the thick crust, and we don't like Chinese food. We both like Vietnamese food. So you get to the point, and so when you're saying I do, you're signing almost like a menu.
One of the things that you notice increasingly in this country are portions. Are you astonished by the food portions that, you know?
Well, we demand that. You know, we as a country demanded that.
It's grown, I mean, exponentially, right?
We wanted that in our supermarkets. We wanted it in our restaurants. The most popular franchise restaurants in the United States are the ones that serve a baked potato the size of your head and a blooming onion that looks like a newborn child. I mean, and the steaks are big, the salad, the biggest salad bar, the biggest steak, the biggest ribs, and the biggest, tallest strawberry shortcake. So we have been, you know, you know, it's what they did was, you know, when you go to a party or a celebration, it's all this food. They're just making a party and celebration for you every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And you get accustomed to it. You get, you know.
And people get angry.
People see the portions of food I eat. They think that I'm the new Gandhi.
Yeah.
I mean, because they can't believe it. But, you know, I have to stay at this weight. I have to fit in those shorts. And they don't make them anymore. So those little 1982 Dolphin shorts, I got to fit in them.
So what is your diet and exercise routine? What did you have, for instance, for breakfast this morning?
I had yogurt, some raw peanuts, and my vitamins, and 3 glasses of water.
And for lunch, you'll have?
For lunch today, I either have a salad for lunch or dinner every day. That has been my secret, because anything, I'm a sandwich person. Anything you put between 2 slices of bread, you can put in a salad. So I'll have a salad, and then tonight I teach a couple classes, so I'll just have some vegetable soup tonight and a couple pieces of fruit, maybe.
And what's your exercise routine today, cardio and weight
training? Well, today I teach for 1.5 hours, but I already did my workout at 5:30 this morning, which is a 15-minute stretching, which includes stretching my body from head to toe, then push-ups, sit-ups, then 600 leg lifts this morning, and then I did...
Wow.
Well, I have to. I put the music on, I become a jukebox ball.
Mm-hmm.
I can't run. I have a lot of medical problems with both my legs, so I can't do a lot of that stuff. But, you know, I do all my bicep, tricep, lats, chest, all that stuff. And then tonight I'll teach 1.5 hours.
You know, I wanted to go back to one thing we were talking about earlier, because I think it's such a significant issue and problem, is when you see a child that's overweight or obese, what do you want to tell them? What would you like to have every parent, every friend of a child? How do you talk to a kid about obesity?
Well, there, you know, a lot of people go, oh, look, it's the genes of the family. And genes do play a slight role in your shape. But when you're a child, you have parents that absolutely adore you, and they start feeding you more, loving you more, cuddling you more, buying you more things, playing with you more. You know, it's this obsessiveness of raising and loving a child, and you think it's cute when they're eating ice cream or a little cake falls, you know, and a parent starts developing in the child's mind, the baby's mind, the rules of eating healthy and not healthy foods. So it's not, you know, the baby is just there and learning what the parents and the grandparents teach them. And you know as well as I, we take our eating habits and we bring them down to the next generation. So before you know it, the kids are eating the hamburgers and the fries. Before you know it, you're taking the kids to the fast food places. You know, before you know it, you go to the doctor and the doctor says your kid's fat. And nobody wants to hear that because, you know, oh, it's baby fat. It's going to go away. What I would love, and, you know, it's a hard thing, but a mom and dad, parents have to learn and take a course, a mandatory course, so they know how to raise a child, how to teach the child better eating habits from a very early age, and how to follow those eating habits themselves. Because, you know, everybody wants to blame the school system. The food in the cafeteria is bad, or there's no PE or little PE. But, you know, this has to start at home, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
This has to start at home. And I think that doctors have to be more well-versed about obese children. You know, there are kids that write me, and the parents are making them have this surgery, and they're 15 years old. Lap band surgery at 15. Come on now. You know, if you want a child, you must take the responsibility of teaching that child how not to have a heart attack and stroke and diabetes and high blood pressure and all the other medical problems that come with obesity.
You know, Richard, you said earlier you've been at this for nearly 40 years. Are you hopeful about a solution?
Sometimes I'm going to be honest with you, and I sit and ponder this late at night when I can't sleep. What more could I be doing? What more could I be saying? It's just that the words of wisdom are now competing with the snake oil salesmen that are inhabiting not only this country but all over the world, and that's, you know, that I'm my voice will never be silenced. I still travel 250 days a year. I work hard. I, you know, do doing my radio show on Sirius Satellite Radio, where I read a letter, and then I call that person live, 200 pounds, 300 pounds, 800 pounds, having one person talk to another person. So, you know, I won't be silenced. It's just a tougher sell. You know, here's a woman, she's been on a diet all her life, you know, she's 48 years old, and they go, why don't you have this stomach thing? Boy, you'll lose the weight, and you'll wear really pretty clothes, and you'll have more friends, and maybe you'll meet somebody, and you know, all the birds in the sky will smile at you.
Mm-hmm. And do people after surgery find out that the world's not changed?
Yeah. Oh, you don't know how many people gain their weight back or have other medical problems. And it's not just that. It's diet pills that doctors are still handing out. It's all of these liquid shakes that you can buy now over the counter. I mean, it's people are still and always will be desperate to lose weight if they don't love themselves. And they're losing weight for the wrong reason.
So, you know, is that, you know, for the many years you've been doing this, what have you learned about the nature of human beings? Are there any things that stand out?
Well, as I said at the beginning of this, people don't know their worth. And that is the biggest problem we have in the United States. Someone's taken their worth away from them, whether through physical abuse, mental abuse, whatever it be. We are walking around like a shell, and most people do not believe in themselves and do not care for themselves that much. And until you can like yourself right now, no matter what you weigh, no matter what you drive, and no matter, you know, where you live, you know, nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change.
Well, I've always thought of you as sort of this patron saint of non-glamorous people. And
well, you know what? There's a song from the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I really can't even play it because I get too teary-eyed. It's sung by Bette Midler, and it's called God Bless the Outcast. I was an outcast as a child and a teenager and a young adult. And the reason I was an outcast was for two reasons. Because the world treated me so bad, and because I treated me so badly. And when I decided what I wanted to do in my life, which was being and helping with people, I decided that my first weapon would have to be unconditional love. And I would have to love everyone the same. And I would just have to be there for them.
Well, that really comes across. I mean, that really, you really understand that when you think about it.
I'm too sensitive for this. I'm getting too old for this.
Yeah.
I sit here and cry. I read these letters, and I've been doing this for years and thousands of emails. And I sit here just in a puddle, and I keep on saying, Richard, get up, give him another speech, get your cheerleader pom-poms, and go to work.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate your spending time with us.
You need.
Thank you much, Richard.
God bless.
Take care. Bye-bye.